There you go. It's running. You'll set it up there.
All right, everyone, I think we should get started before we lose too much of our time. I hope everybody's doing well, is nice and warm and toasty this cold day. Our goals for today are we're going to spend some time in the 10th century, if you'll come with me, a little time travel. We're in lesson 11 in our Crossroads curriculum, and today we're talking about what we're going to refer to today as the age of Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And our goals for today are to look at history, and we're going to really spend some time in one particular time period, being the 10th century, but in a couple different places. And I would like to read one text from medieval Spain that's not in your reader, a text by a woman. Thank you. Two texts from medieval Ashkenaz, from medieval Europe, which I'm guessing is probably the origin of many of our ancestors sitting around these tables. And these two texts will exemplify cultural differences and the different socio-cultural, historical contexts in which our ancestors found themselves that relate somewhat to how we experience our lives today. So that's that. Where last we left off last week, we were talking about Jews in Babylonia, we were talking about the Talmud, we were talking about rabbinic academies, and we were talking about the difference between authority within the Jewish community, so Jewish leaders who hold authority over other Jews in particular ways, versus the non-Jewish authorities who sort of ran the scene in these various lands, and how they related to Jewish leaders, and what kind of authority those leaders might have over Jewish people. And the reality is that kind of tension of who do we look to as our leaders, who sets the agenda for what's important to us as a community, even today, right, we might find there's, we have a problem with the city of Pittsburgh, who do we call? We all call Dan Gilman, right? He's like, well, we know him, we see him pushing the stroller, like, right? I mean, but he doesn't have any authority within the Jewish community, right? I mean, he's not who we call when we need to know medical ethics, right? So then we'll call Rabbi Bisno or any one of our other rabbis. So those kind of tensions that we see in our lives today, very similar going backwards in time. Just so you know, the first half of this lesson is my actual area of specialty that I studied at JTS for way too many years. So if you have questions, please raise them, because I have to put that education to you somehow. So we're gonna talk, we'll talk first about the origins of Sephardi Jews and what today, Spain, Iberia. During the last several lessons that we've had, if we wanted to kind of track what was happening with the Jewish community in Spain, there were actually Jewish people there. There were Jewish people in Iberia, beginning even before the destruction of the Second Temple, during this period that I was referring to as the Roman globalization. Jews were everywhere, and there were a number of emerging urban centers, even urban centers in the way that we think of urban centers, in Iberia at the time under Rome. One of them was the city of Cordoba, and another was here, in Latin, was called Tarraco. You might know Tarragona, outside of Barcelona. Anybody been there? Lovely, lovely Roman ruins there right along the coast. Interestingly, when I, 20 years ago, when I lived in Spain, one of my friends took me along part of the walls, and you can actually see Hebrew engravings where the city planners had taken old Jewish gravestones and put them into the walls in Tarragona. Yeah. So I don't know if people have been to Spain. I don't know if anybody has done the kind of Jewish tourism that has emerged there, what they call Ruta Sefardita, meaning the Sephardi route, right? Like looking at the old Jewish places. But I think it's important for us to understand, you know, again, I won't bury the lead. The Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492 from the Spanish kingdoms. By the time the Jews are expelled, their history in Spain is already, you know, 1,500 years and more in terms of their living there, which I think even for us as American Jews is hard to understand, because when we think of the American Jewish community, we have some sense that maybe there were Jews here from the first settlements, but really we think in hundreds of years. But to think of a Jewish presence in the land of Spain for more than 1,000 years, for 1,500 years, for 1,600 years, is really something. So the identity of Sephardi Jews is something that's held very dear to them and is very deeply connected to this particular land. So what happens? We learned about Islam, right? That when Muhammad has his prophecies, and then for any number of reasons, Islam becomes the sort of second globalization in the Mediterranean, that as the Arabian Muslims spread out through North Africa, they come all the way to Spain. And in the year 711, in fact, they conquer the Iberian Peninsula all the way up into France, and this sets the stage for the remainder of Spanish Jewish history and any number of ideas, and this term that you might hear, the Reconquest or the Reconquista. Next week, we'll speak about the Crusades and how they emerge in Central Europe. But the thing about Spain is they didn't need to go back to the Holy Land to take their ideas, their holy places back from the Muslims, because in Spain they have their very own reconquest, their very own kind of locally born crusade right here on their land. And the Christian Visigothic kings who had been ruling in the years after Rome collapsed were pushed to the north and then slowly worked to gain headway and retake the peninsula. So where are the Jews in all this? Anybody want to guess? What did the Jews do? You got Christians, you got Muslims, everybody's fighting, borders. What happens?
Assimilation.
Radar. Pardon?
Flying under the radar.
Doing whatever it takes to survive. So prior to the Muslim conquest in the 8th century, the Christian Visigothic kings had been occasionally forcibly converting Jewish children, occasionally taking Jewish children and forcing them to go to schools in churches. So the Muslims, the Arabian Muslims who end up coming to Spain are not actually the fundamentalists. They are not the fanatics. They're the kind of people who want to be as far away from the central religious authorities of their own religion as possible. Their approach to an indigenous Jewish population was very different. So we've talked about the different categories in which Christians and Jews could find themselves under Muslim rule. And very, very early on, the Jewish population of Iberia realized, hey, these are the Muslims who want to come and drink wine and write poetry and not live under the strictest iteration of Islam. They have a category for us where we can be ourselves. Let's cut a deal. And, you know, the textual history for this, you know, the actual documentation that we have for this, we don't really have stuff from the 8th century about how the Jewish people helped the Muslims conquer Iberia, but that ends up becoming a part of the narrative. But by the 10th century, by the 900s, where we find ourselves today, we do have documentation showing that Jewish people were very involved with the political life of the ruling Muslim classes of Iberia in the medieval period. And it ends up being good for everyone, for any number of reasons. So I decided at this point, by the 900s, by the 10th century, there are Jewish settlements all throughout basically every area of Spain that was urbanized at that point. Many of those places were Roman cities that then the Muslim rulers just came in and started to, you know, use whatever Roman technology was left there and to settle there. But what becomes sort of the crown or the capital of the caliphate, as it is called, is that city of Cordoba in Andalusia, in what is today Andalusia. Has anybody been there? I'm just curious. Yeah. So Cordoba is a very special place. It's along the banks of the Guadalquivir River, which these days kind of looks more like the Guadalquivir, I don't know, puddle. but at the time it was a river. Something also interesting to think about is that Spain was apparently much more woodsy before the Romans got there, and that the Romans actually did what we humans tend to do, the environment, which was pillage it. So the sort of images that we have of Andalusia today were not necessarily what originally it was like under Roman rule. This picture that I've put up here, does anybody know what this is? This is just outside of Cordoba, less than a day's travel by donkey. this is what was considered the palace. It's a palace city, a palatial city called Medinat al-Zahra, the brilliant city. And these are the ruins. This was basically, the oasis, let's say, outside of the urban center for the ruling caliphs. And you can visit it today, and you can see there were gardens, there were all kinds of palace fortresses. I tried to find photos to show you what it might have been like to go into the Jewish quarter in Cordoba. So architecture in the Arab context is very different, because the notion of public and private space is different than what we have today, where the focus is on private space rather than public space. So when you walk down, this is a gate right next to what would have been the Jewish quarter in old Cordoba under Muslim rule. And when you go in, the streets all look like this, where they're very winding, and as in many places in Andalusia and throughout the Muslim world, in North Africa and the Middle East, if you were to go into any one of these little doors, you would go through, and the gardens, the private gardens, are where the focus for beauty, for gathering spaces. So everything is internal. So you don't see any of that when you go down the street. So I don't know if you can see it, but it actually says on the wall here of this street, Calle Judíos, Jew Street. Mm-hmm. To this day, Jew Street. And as you walk down it, you can see a very famous statue of Maimonides that was put into place in the 1990s. So Maimonides, the great scholar, ended up living in Fostat in Egypt, but was born in Cordoba in the 12th century. And this is a photograph from inside the one remaining synagogue that is left in Cordoba. You would never know it was a synagogue. You're just walking by. I mean, there's a little plaque outside, and you open, and it's really just one large room. It was used in later years by a guild in the medieval period. It was never looked after properly as a synagogue. And there's, you know, you can see the architecture and the decoration that is left of the plaster is all in a Muslim style. The other famous landmark in Cordoba, so here, this is the Guadalquivir puddle, the river, with the bridge over it. And then you can see, this is the Great Mosque of Cordoba, which was one of the most outstanding architectural achievements of the medieval period, of the caliphate. It's this lovely, lovely old mosque. It's huge. It was added onto each subsequent ruler, embellished it, made it more and more beautiful. It has these very stereotypical arches that are unique to its construction that end up becoming a motif that's repeated in later years. And then after the Christians take back Cordoba, they basically drop a Gothic cathedral right in the middle of the mosque. So it's a bit of cognitive dissonance to go in and see all of the things you would expect to find in a mosque, and then all of a sudden there's a cathedral right in the middle of it. So that's Cordoba, and that's Medinat al-Zahra, the palatial city just outside of Cordoba. And I want to sort of take us back there for a very particular reason. One of the most distinctive cultural productions that emerge out of this context in which Jewish people are living not only in peace with their Muslim rulers, but in full kind of cooperation economically, politically, etc., is that Jewish art begins to flourish in a way that it never has before. And the scholars, when they sort of rediscovered Judaism from a more scientific perspective in the 19th century, they call this time period the Golden Age of Spain. Why do they call it the Golden Age of Spain? Well, we have all of these amazing textual artifacts that have come down to us in which Jewish people, rabbis, courtiers are describing their life. And let me tell you, it sounds like a good life. They're drinking wine, they're writing poems, they're doing science. They're doing Jewish learning, they're doing Jewish law. There's a little bit of that Talmud stuff. Just to the south of Cordoba, there's a city called Lucena that has a famous rabbinic academy that emerges also in this period. But really, it seems like the Jewish people are doing quite well. And there is one particular courtier who is in the court of Abd al-Rahman III, who is the caliph in the 10th century, who is definitely interested in not following the strictest interpretation of Islam, we'll put it that way. He's interested in a more liberal kind of vision of Islam. And his right-hand man is a Jewish courtier named Khastai ibn Shafrut. And the great thing about Khastai is that in his exposure to everything around him, he chooses to become a patron of the arts. And what the Jewish arts end up being in this period is there is a long tradition of Arabic poetry. It was an oral poetry. It had its own genres. It was all in the same kind of high classical Arabic that Muhammad receives the prophecies in the Quran. So it's a very particular kind of language. And people in Cordoba, although they may have never lived in a tent in the desert, are writing this kind of beautiful poetry. And there's a lot of discussion of al-Arabiya, the notion that the Arabic language is the most pure, beautiful language in the world. Well, how do you think Jewish people responded to that? Jewish people believe that the world itself was created through the power of Hebrew words and letters. So if Muslims have a reverence for the Arabic language, the Jewish people in Cordoba were saying, hey, we have our own even more ancient, even more perfect, even more powerfully creative language of Hebrew. And so Khastai ibn Shafrut, the right-hand man of Abd al-Rahman, ends up becoming the first patron of a Jewish poet, and a man named Dunash ibn Labrat becomes the first of the medieval Hebrew poets. And he starts writing poetry in Hebrew, using the same meter, the same rhyme schemes, all the same genres as the Arab poets of his day. And it's something totally new. Of course, there's some people who don't like it, right? There are some people who say, well, that's not what Hebrew's meant for. You're taking all of these words that only appear in the Bible, you know, that are only in the prophets or that are only in the Torah, and you're talking about sex, you're talking about love, you're talking about all these things. Maybe it's not appropriate. But it seems like the vast majority of people did not have that feeling, because it really catches on. And the medieval Hebrew poets end up becoming a thing for the next several hundred years. So if we peel back the curtain, So you've got the caliph, you've got his Jewish right-hand man, you've got the medieval Hebrew poet, the first guy to write some medieval Hebrew poetry down. You peel back the curtain, who's there? His wife. And in the Diwan of Dunash, so Diwan means like uv or corpus, right? And they would put all their poems together into one book called a Diwan. And in the Diwan of Dunash, he gave us a little present. He writes in Arabic, and here is a poem that my wife wrote. And thank you to Peter Cole, I have a translation of that poem for us to read today. So it's the only poem we have that says this was written by a woman from the medieval period. We don't even know her name, the same way we called Noah's wife Eshet Noach, right? We don't know her name, we call her Eshet Dunash, Dunash's wife. But I thought it would be a nice little taste, and we could say a thank you back in time to, I'm certain there had to be more women writing medieval Hebrew poetry, because again, the Jews were exceptionally literate compared to the other people of the time period. Women also were often taught how to read and write. So, would anyone like to read? We're just gonna read the lines at the bottom. Will her love remember? And I don't know if a woman would be willing to read and channel Eshet Dunash, Dunash's wife, for us today. Thank you, Joan.
Sure. Will her love remember his graceful Joe, her only son in her arms as he parted? On her left hand, he placed a ring from his right. On his wrist, she placed her bracelet. As a keepsake, she took his mantle from him, and he in turn took hers from her. Would he settle now in the land of Spain if its prince gave him half his kingdom? Wow.
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 Does anybody want to describe what's happening in the poem? So, the graceful doe, Ayalat Chen, she's called in Hebrew. Sometimes it's also a doe or a deer. So sometimes it's the Tzvi Chen, it's the male deer. Sometimes the poems are written to a male or about a male beloved or lover. So this image of the doe is very characteristic of all of this poetry. You'll see it everywhere. You'll see it in almost every poem. It's why I could never name my kid like Tzvi. It would have been too obvious. Or Ayala, it would have been like a little too on brand, right? Margalit, being my daughter's name, is like close enough, because it means like jewels, also like a little maybe too poetic. But that's an image that's not anywhere else in Hebrew literature prior to this poetry that begins in the 10th century, and it becomes a theme that you'll see for the next hundreds of years. They all write about this doe, and that's because it's an image that's lifted directly from Arabic poetry. So that's what, if you see, when you start seeing deer frolicking around, you know you're in the world of a love poem.
Is it true of mountain goat also, Yael?
The mountain goat, not the same, which is very interesting because that's what we would expect, because the Ya'alim are something characteristic of sort of our land, right? The land of Israel, and do appear in other kinds of Hebrew literature, but not in this literature. In this literature, we're in a desert situation that really is from the Arabian Peninsula dropped into Iberia. You know, there's a lot of gardens, there's a lot of fountains, sort of trickling, there's the moon reflected in a goblet of wine. These are kind of the characteristic images. So you'll see here, it's very interesting in this poem. So she's talking about a woman whose lover is leaving with their child. And she makes direct reference to settling in Spain and a kind of political situation, which is so interesting if you think about how art and life are sort of interwoven One of the problems with this kind of poetry, and this is something that the scholarship has had to deal with, is that these poems, they'll talk about a lover or a beloved, and in the Diwan, in the collections, the poem is always in Hebrew, and there's always a little explanation before it, usually written in Arabic or in Judeo-Arabic, so that is Arabic language, but written in Hebrew letters, that will say, the poet wrote this before setting out on a trip, or she, you know, you might say before this one, the poet wrote this before her husband left on a trip. Mm-hmm. And then the scholars come along in the 19th century and they say, she wrote this because her husband went on a trip. Well, you know, can we really read the life of the artist out of the art? It's sort of a tension. And the other main issue with a lot of this poetry is that it's homoerotic. It's written by a male poet about a male beloved. And it's often almost has a tone of pederasty, which is a much older lover and a much younger beloved, where the youth who's coming to pour the wine is sort of gazed upon in a particular way and objectified in a particular way. So it's a little bit tense because a lot of the men who are writing these poems are also rabbis. They're also the scholars, and they're referred to as rabbis, you know, the rabbis who commentated on the Torah in those years, etc. So whether or not there was actually a sort of, I don't know, lived homosexual experience among the people in this era, particularly in the Jewish community, it's not known. And the different scholars all come at a different perspective and come up to different conclusions after analyzing the literature. But I think it's something just to be aware of, and it's also, look, hardly anyone teaches medieval Hebrew poetry these days. The Hebrew itself is incredibly difficult. I mean, Israelis actually need a gloss to understand it. It's almost like when we read Shakespeare and you need like the little crib notes on what are those words even, right? So Israelis themselves have a hard time understanding this poetry. In the diaspora, it's hardly ever taught. When it is taught, it's very difficult to understand because this is a Muslim cultural context. You know, it's 1,000 years ago. It's very, there's a lot to get to till you can get to the poem. And then certainly there's very little of a woman's voice. So I've taught you the most niche of the most niche of the most possibly niche topics within the realm of Jewish studies. But if there's one gift I could give you from all these 25 weeks, it's knowing that a woman wrote a poem in this very fancy style. Alas, every golden age has its end. So I'm just going to flip back to the map.
So could you tell more about the poem? So he's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And she's staying?
That's what it seems like.
And he's taking the baby.
Or the child,
The child.
You know, they're on the horse, so maybe they're riding the horse together.
Right, and so he's leaving from where? So what's the last sentence
mean? Well, what do you think it means?
Well, I'm trying to figure out is he leaving Spain? Is that what you think?
I think he's leaving from wherever they are and going to Spain.
Going to Spain,
whatever it is. And so the word that they use for Spain in these medieval Hebrew poems is Sepharad. That's why we call it Sephardi Jews. If the prince gave him half his kingdom, well, you know, there is someone already in Spain who has, you know, a lot of political power in the kingdom as a Jewish person, this courtier, Chastai. So I see it as a literary artifact. I don't see it as an autobiographical kind of poem. It's interesting, sort of the material culture that's represented, right? The jewelry, the mantle, like their scarves, the exchange of scarves. To me, that is more telling about what someone's daily life was like than the going, if somebody is actually going to Spain or where they were going or where they were coming from. Because especially in this early period, it's very difficult to know where the poet is just using a genre, maybe even directly translating a poem from Arabic into Hebrew, or where they're actually speaking from something in their heart or something that actually happened. It's really not until about 100 years after this with someone called Shmuel Hanagid, Shmuel the Prince. He was the right-hand man of the King of Granada. And he actually is someone who we know about from Hebrew manuscripts of the era and from Arabic manuscripts of the era. So we have his life and his biographical details attested to both from a Muslim perspective and from a Jewish perspective. So his name among the Muslims was Ismail ibn Nagrila, Samuel the Black. He must have had very dark hair. And he writes about being on the battlefield, and he writes about his brother dying, and he writes about his sons. And we know that all those things were true, that he was on the battlefield, that his brother died, and that he had sons, also from Arabic manuscript history. So with him, he's the first one that we can really say, like, oh, he actually, you know, if he has these poems from the battlefield, oh, they actually were, you know, I don't think he was necessarily there with his parchment and his quill lying next to his horse riding it at night, but he was reflecting his actual time spent on the battlefield.
Which century?
11th century.
It sounds to me as though the child is staying with her.
Will her love remember his graceful dough?
Oh, right.
Only son in her arms as he holds.
Oh, right. Not in his arms. Yeah.
So it sounds like he's going off to do
he's
whatever
going off.
He's
right,
going
right,
off
right.
to do.
There we go.
And she's wondering if he'll ever come back.
Right. That's better. Thank you. I forgot. I did put up, there's medievalhebrewpoetry.org. if anybody really wants to go down that rabbit hole.
Wow.
So if you ever want to check that out. I just want to flip back to the map briefly because... So talking about the 10th century when this poetry emerges for the first time and we have the first Hebrew poets, unfortunately, the sort of magnanimous rulers of Muslim Spain didn't last long, right? A time of peace is never going to last that long. And eventually, increasingly more fanatic waves of conquerors come from North Africa. And as the Christians gain power and the Muslims face different kinds of threats from within and kind of infighting, the Christians slowly retake the peninsula, and eventually the caliphate is broken up into taifa kingdoms or city-states, which again, how do the Jews handle this? They do the best that they can. That's how that guy, Shmuel Hanagid, Ismail ibn Nagrila, becomes the right-hand man in Granada, is because Granada ceases to be just a city in the caliphate and becomes its own kingdom. So as all of this is happening, essentially there's more and more opportunities for Jewish people, because if it goes from being one unified kingdom to a bunch of small kingdoms, then there's need for more scribes, need for more tax collectors, need for more city planners, right? Need for more physicians. So the Jews end up really thriving and flourishing to the extent that they're able, during the period of the 11th and 12th centuries, beginning in the 13th century, when the Reconquest really begins in earnest, it starts to be that it's better for Jews to be in the north under Christian rule. The Muslims lose more and more ground until eventually in 1492. Granada is the last stronghold of Islam in Iberia. The Christian kings unite. They take over Granada and kick the Jews out. So that's in two lessons time, we'll talk about that. Yes.
In our Reconstructionist Prayer Book, we have poems by Solomon ibn Gabirol, 12th century, but I know nothing about him. Is he?
So he's from this period of the Taifa kingdoms. I believe he's from Malaga. He, apparently, according to his poems, he was kind of a sickly fellow. He died young. He thought very highly of himself. He was a philosopher, and indeed one of his works of philosophy, this is medieval Spain in a nutshell. One of his works of philosophy only remained in manuscript form in Latin, and it wasn't until the 19th century that they realized it was actually by a Jewish philosopher. They had called him, In Spanish, we call him Abete Bron, from his Latin name, not from Ibn Gabirol. And interestingly, you all know a poem that he wrote. You may not know it. Anybody know what famous poem he wrote? We sing it all the time. Adon Olam.
Oh, wow.
The reason why Adon, you know how Adon Olam, you can sing it to any tune?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's because the meter of these medieval Hebrew poems is so strict. It's so like specific in terms of long syllables and short syllables. And I'm pretty sure that the name for that meter in Hebrew is the merubeh, which means the square meter. So it's basically the medieval Hebrew equivalent of 4-4 time. And anything that's in that meter, you can put to any tune because it's Adon Olam Asher Malach B'Terem Kol Yitzir Nivra, right? It's like very, very regular in terms of the short and long syllables. So you didn't even know. So that's like, you know, medieval Hebrew poetry. There's actually quite a bit. Yigdal is another famous medieval Hebrew poem that we sing all the time. There's a number of poems that became a part of the liturgy and have been handed down to us. And whenever you sing it from now on, I don't have a good picture of the garden, but you can kind of imagine that you're really wandering down one of these roads, and a narrow whitewashed street with the poet who's about to compose that poem. Yes?
You mentioned that the Arabic architecture had more internal life than external. That must have been adopted by the Spanish as well.
Yes.
And that moved to Latin America as well.
And some of the rationale for that has to do with Muslims culture, Muslim culture's roots in Iberia, where you spent a lot of your space, or sorry, in Arabia, prior to Islam, in Arabian cultures, you spent time in the tent. So as urbanization increased, internal space or family space continued to be the dominant factor. So that's why, a focus, there's not like a public garden, there's not a big public square in the old part of Cordoba, there's just all these little streets. However, at the mosque, I don't have a good photo, well, kind of. You can see at the mosque, there is an open court. That would have been a space for public gathering. But for the most part, internal space. This also has to do with women's role under Islam, where women were very much kept at home in a way that Jewish women really weren't. And women's sphere being very much internal and men's sphere being much more public. And that wasn't something that was native to the Jewish populations there prior to the advent of Islam. Yeah, Renee?
It also reminds me of some of the homes in the old city.
Exactly.
Where you're behind a wall and you walk in, and first you have the courtyard, and then you have these massive amounts of steps into the private family home.
Beautiful, exactly. Exactly. It's exactly that. That's the amazing thing. Like the same way where today you might not know if you're on the street in New York or Berlin or Tel Aviv, right? Like there's a certain kind of urbanization that's globalization that's shared. If we could time travel, we could be in Cordoba, we could be in Jerusalem, we could be in any number of cities and experiencing the same kind of globalization just in that cultural context. So we're gonna kind of shift gears just a little bit. I didn't even do a time check. Okay, so we're gonna do Ashkenazi history in 15 minutes. So in the way that I had said that there were Jewish people in Iberia since before the destruction of the Second Temple, since the Roman expansion in Iberia, that is not the case for Ashkenazi Jewry. Ashkenazi Jewry was a much more recent introduction into Central Europe and into Europe. And I, on the flip side of Dunash's wife's poem, I gave you a map. As the Jewish community was expanding throughout the Mediterranean world, was developing trade routes, was going through Italy, what is today Italy, up into Europe. You can see that we didn't get very far right? If you can see the dark black dots sort of along the bottom border of the map I've shown you, were where you could find Jews around the year 500. By the year 1000, Jews had slowly migrated further in to what we would call Ashkenaz, into lands of today Germany and France. And the process of settlement was very different than for the Jewish people. Because there weren't indigenous communities, as Jewish people came in, they basically had to create individual charters with whoever was in charge at whatever place they were going. And whether the person in charge was more from an ecclesiastical perspective, so in some places it was the bishop, in some places it was, you know, whoever in the church hierarchy held the power. In other places, it was a more secular leadership, whether it was a duke, a baron, a king. And in a much more difficult kind of situation, whereas under Islam, all Jewish people were a particular category of dhimmi, of this protected class. You registered with your community, you paid your taxes, you did what you liked. In Ashkenaz, it was very different. Individual Jewish people came to those, the double dots, the sort of like the dot with the circle around it, came to those places by a process of making individual charters. So Sharon, if you're the bishop, I come to you and I say, I'm here, I have goods to trade, may I trade at your fair? And you say, I don't know you, you're here by yourself, you probably can't make too much trouble, those are some nice jewels you have, I'll give you permission to trade at this fair and this fair only, and then when you're done, you know, when the fair is over, goodbye, okay? I come back the next year, I say, Bishop Sharon, I'm back. I noticed last time you all needed some salt, I brought salt. And I've got my son and his wife with me. Can we stay? Can we trade at the fair? You say yes. And that's essentially how all of those settlements started, with one person, one permission to stay. And then, you know, of course, some of them might have gotten permission originally to settle and stay for longer, not just for the fair, but it was on an individual basis. And we do have some of these charters. We have some very famous examples of documentary history that luckily, you know, some of the churches actually held on to this stuff. So we have documents of original charters of Jews settling in this area. Yes?
Where did these Jews come from?
This is a great question.
They're not Sephardic that moved here.
For the most part, they're not Sephardic. So you can see that they came in this sort of iteration, they came from Rome. Right? They came from Roman-held lands, from Roman settlements after the crumble of the Roman Empire. They moved northwards. But this is a brilliant question, and someone asks this question every time I teach this course, Diane, so you were the winner chicken dinner this time. Ultimately, all of these Jews came from Judea. They all came from Palestine. And this is, I think, a really, as a Zionist, I feel compelled to say, this is a really important point, because the narrative in today's news, I mean, we could turn on the news right now, God forbid, about what's happening in Israel, is that the Ashkenazi Jews are white colonizers who have come to the land of Israel just like the other European people, and I'm telling you, it's not. We are indigenous to the land of Israel. And the amazing thing about Ashkenazi Jewry, and maybe this says something about our own problems today, is that I think even from a genetic perspective, they've traced it back to something like 32 individuals who started the settlements in Ashkenaz. That like somehow Ashkenazi Jews were, genetic research becomes more and more sophisticated. These charters that we have that say, you know, the individual person and his son who came to Ashkenaz, it's sort of bearing out that really there weren't that many Jews who settled in these communities. I want to zoom in on three particular communities that are very important for the history of Ashkenazi Jewry, that are important for the history of our scholarship, that are important for everything that happens next. If you look along the Rhine River, we call them the Shum communities, because we actually read them from south to north. If you think about in almost the literal order of settlement from south to north, of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. They were called the Shum communities. And if you ever are reading anything about Ashkenazi history, if you see that the Shum communities, they're referring specifically to those three cities, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, along the Rhine River Valley. And similar to Spain, our material cultural history in these lands, there's not a lot for me to show you that dates back to this time period, but I found some pretty pictures of, like, this is a bridge in Worms, and this is the cathedral in Worms, and here are the what's left of a little synagogue from Worms in Germany. I've never been there. I've never been to these places. The places in Spain I've been all over, but I haven't. I've never been along the Rhine River Valley. Has anybody been there? Yeah.
We were in Cologne just a few years ago, and right next to the very large church, mm-hmm. there was a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
We could not go in it,
right,
because they had found a Jewish bath.
Right, a mikveh.
It was called mm-hmm. the mikveh, and they were excavating that, and we just had to go look at it. We were in Spears. Went from Cologne.
Yeah.
Spears, right?
It's amazing to me the willingness to take risks among these merchant settlers who would go out in such small numbers in areas they'd never been in before and just settle and put down roots. There have been studies, I think, of Arab asking the same questions. Why didn't the Arab merchants do the same
right.
in the same period?
Right. It's a great question. I mean, I think that there's I think there's something about our ability to be cultural shapeshifters and, like, our willingness to do whatever it took, right? That if there's opportunity to go out there and find it. I mean, I think even what I've learned about the history of the Jews of Western Pennsylvania,
yeah.
you know, people who would set up shop in Newcastle or Erie or, you know, these places, to me, like, that seems, you know, just as foreign as going to
or than south,
right? Right, so much more so, right?
All the different communities that they wound up in,
right?
And maybe they were only a few of them, and even today, if they're well, maybe not so much today, but maybe 30 years ago, and they all went to the same Jewish camp,
right?
To keep the kids together,
right?
But they went out by themselves.
It's the wandering Jews. Okay, so in our last, like, 7 minutes, I want one more question. Yeah.
What are these circles that are on this map? It doesn't explain what those are.
Oh, are those mountains, maybe? I think those are mountains.
Oh.
Yeah, because it has pass in between.
Yeah, I think those, I mean, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think those are mountains.
All right.
I didn't see the synagogue when I went to Cologne. I just went to the Christmas market. it was that time of year. Okay, so to give you a snapshot of the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews, I want to read a text. It wasn't written down till the 13th century, but this is from Rabbeinu Gershom. He's called Me'or HaGolah, the light of the diaspora. He lived in the 10th century, so thinking about the same time that Eshet Dunash is writing that poem, right, of holding her baby, watching her husband go off. This is great. These are the rules that he sets for Ashkenazi Jewry, okay? So we all know the difference between Passover, between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews. Some people may know it in their own kitchen. Some people may know about it more theoretically. During Passover, Sephardi Jews eat kitniot, eat rice and beans. Why do they eat kitniot? Well, let me tell you, friends, they actually had rice and beans to eat in Iberia that they didn't have in the Rhine River Valley. The reason why Ashkenazi Jews don't eat those things on Passover is because, realistically, for all those hundreds of years, we didn't have access to that kind of food. It was an irrelevant question. It was just, I mean, it would be, you know, like whatever they eat on Mars, like, we're not going to eat that during Passover because we don't have that, right? Almost that different. So let's hear what Rabbeinu Gershom set as the rules and the standards for Ashkenazi Jewry, and then we can talk about why that didn't work for Sephardi Jewry. Anybody want to read? We're on text 4. Sorry. We're on text 4 in the book. I have no idea what page it is. This is lesson
120.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. From lesson 11, text 4. It says, the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, Me'or HaGolah. So, and the reason why it says 13th century is because it's from a 13th century manuscript. He lived at the same time as Dunash, just, you know, you can kind of imagine them on the map. We could take the same time machine. Somebody read? Diane, you gonna read? Thank you.
A cherem, excommunication or ban, is placed upon anyone who transgresses these laws. It is forbidden to leave the synagogue after the prayers begun if the minyan is small. The minority must submit to the decisions of the majority in a communal dispute. Travelers and visitors must contribute to the collections for the poor in towns where they reside. It is forbidden to read another man's letter. It is forbidden to marry more than one wife. It is forbidden to divorce a wife forcibly and against her will.
Okay. In Jewish life, authority has always been local. The rabbi of another town doesn't know what's happening in your town, so you only ask that rabbi for advice or ask that rabbi what to do if it's a matter of a very serious importance. You always go to your local authority. So Rabbeinu Gershom is setting the laws for a very particular set of people with a very particular set of sociological constraints on their lives. These communities were tiny when they were founded. So when you think about making a rule, you can't leave the synagogue after prayers have started if the minyan is small, that's because often in many places, you really only had 10 men. Interestingly, to connect back to what Renee mentioned about Cologne, the first thing that would be built in a town when the Jews would get permission to settle there in a group of more than just a family or two is a mikvah, is a ritual bath. Not a synagogue, not a school, not a kosher butcher shop, but a mikvah.
Not even a cemetery?
Pardon?
Not even a cemetery.
Not even a cemetery. A mikvah is the first thing that is built because a mikvah is what indicates that there's actually going to be the need for family laws happening, right? And if you want to continue the people, you need to be able to enact those laws. The minority must submit to the majority. In these tiny communities, you know how arguments can break out. I don't have to tell you what it's like. Travelers and visitors have to contribute to the poor. You can't just come and freeload as you're going from fair to fair, you know, throughout the medieval world. Can't read each other's letters. They relied on each other to carry mail. So there had to be some kind of discretion, particularly because business was transacted through all these letters. So you don't want to find out what you're, you know, you don't want to find out through nefarious means what your colleague is planning to bring next season so you can compete, right? This is very self-protective. It is forbidden to marry more than one wife. So this is called the Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom, the statute of Rabbeinu Gershom. He has a separate thing about this, that it was good for 1,000 years. It just expired. And it was only incumbent on, Ashkenazi Jews. And as far as I know, no other rabbis with the status of Rabbeinu Gershom have enacted this takana over Ashkenazi Jews again. So polygamy is back in the Ashkenazi world.
I'm Sephardic.
Well, unfortunately, because also under Islam, one was allowed to have more than one wife, polygamy was never banned among Sephardic Jews. And I've read, there's a whole literature called the responsa literature, which is people from local communities writing to rabbis about these major issues. And there is some really spicy stuff in the 13th century in Spain. Like, you don't need to watch a telenovela or soap opera or Game of Thrones. You could just read these medieval documents about the kind of stuff that our ancestors were going through, and it was enough to make me blush. But so what you see here is very interesting. There definitely was contact between Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jews at this period, and there definitely was travel, dangerous as it was, between Sephardi lands and Ashkenazi lands. So one of the reasons why Rabbeinu Gershom has to enact this takana is because, first of all, the Christians are not gonna let us settle there if we come with our whole harem of wives. Because under Christianity, there's only one man and one woman in a marriage situation, right? However, under Islam, you've got three or four wives as long as you can support them. It's no problem. One of the reasons why he enacts this takana is because he's worried that these traders are going to have a wife back in Cordoba and a wife here on the Rhine River Valley. So it's a very interesting kind of snapshot that gives you insight into the difference of the two communities and the different kinds of pressures that living under Christianity placed versus Islam, right? So under Islam, you have the kahilah, the community, a protected status, a protected political status for Jews. Under Christianity, it's a little bit more like the Wild West, where in each individual community, there has to be a negotiation for each individual Jewish person on being allowed to live there. Yes?
So Danielle, is monogamy primarily a Christian innovation then that we've adopted?
That's a good question. I don't know that much about the biblical period or what kind of archaeological evidence we have that Jewish people really had that many wives. Once Jews started to become more urbanized and settled down, once we kind of stopped wandering so much, once we get past the era of the patriarchs, anecdotally, like in the scriptural text, we don't hear a lot about multiple wives. I think economically it was difficult outside of a kind of, more pastoral, like tribal setting to maintain a family with multiple wives. It's something that the Talmud doesn't seem to indicate that those rabbis living in Babylonia or whatever, that they had more than one wife. So I think it may be the kind of thing where it wasn't forbidden to us, but maybe it came back a little bit when we were living under Islam, because that was one of the cultural norms, is that if you had enough money, you could have more than one wife. Yeah.
Is there any relationship between the fatwa of Islam and the harem of the Jewish communities?
Yes, definitely. They're both similar because they kind of, if you think about the ways that Sharia law and halakha, Jewish law, are similar in that they dictate our daily lives, the fatwa is an instrument of communal punishment in the same way that a harem was. Although, a harem in this situation under Christian rule could be really dangerous. Like if you got thrown out of the Jewish community, you would basically have to convert to Christianity. Like you didn't have another option. Especially if you think about how close some of these Ashkenazi communities were to each other. Like you'd have to get really far away before they didn't know that you were banned. So this is something that we don't really do in the same way anymore. But if someone was refusing a get, or if someone was behaving inappropriately, the ban was a real instrument of punishment in a way that is just, reforming conservative Jews. We don't do that. Okay, that's it. I'm sorry that we went over.
Is anybody going to Shooters?
Oh.
What did
she say?
Is anybody going to Ralph Shooters now?
Danielle,
why
did you
across the street from the
Maritime
Center?
That's a great question.
If you share.
Yeah, no, I do. I'm